Sometimes it's scary to go back to school. You know, if you've been out for a while, maybe you can still remember that. I think I was talking with somebody the other day that said, you know, a grown adult saying, like, I still remember the anxiety, the anticipation, the eagerness, and the worry that going back to school is. Because it can be a scary place. It can be an enjoyable place. Sometimes it can be a big, bad place. Sometimes it can be a place of tremendous memories and impact. And as parents, we feel that. We feel that maybe sometimes more than the kids. I mean, I wonder, we see all these Facebook posts and things that are happening in the first day of school pictures, and I wonder, who's more nervous? Is it the parents or is it the kids? Is it the ones that are heading into the unknowns or the ones that have been there before and saying like, oh my gosh, I remember, and things have changed so much since when I went to school? I was looking at Yahoo, which is my source of all information in the world. I was looking at Yahoo and I found this article that was written from a parent nervous about their child going to school. And I want to read parts of this for you, okay? I selectively grabbed a couple sentences and it keeps with the essence of what this letter. What it was is this parent wrote a letter to their child, hoping and communicating some things as they go back to school, okay? It says, I walked into your new school feeling like it was my first day. You're ready, confident, and some people consider you different in a bad way. There's no right way to do this. It's up to you, to us, to figure it out, because I promise I will be with you every step of the way. You are bold, joyful, proud, and passionate. You are perfect just as you are. People are not always going to understand you or us. That's okay. Have fun. Be yourself. You're courageous, inspirative, creative, and thoughtful. And you are so very kind. Just as I hope every person you encounter in school will be kind to you, I hope you will do your part to help spread kindness. You never know someone else's story, and you can't assume that you have a clue. Everyone has their own stuff going on at all times. If you extend kindness, you will feel good about that, and so will those you encounter. Stand up for yourself and what you know is right. Dig into your well of courage and speak up if someone is being rude to you or to someone else. If you don't have the willpower to speak up at that moment, talk to someone who can help you. Getting help is brave. Lastly, please remember, I am always here no matter what. I'm here to cheer when happiness prevails, to speak out when you cannot, and to give a killer pep talk when you need it the most. I mean, do you hear the love from a parent to a child? Now let me ask you, what kind of situation do you think that child is? Who do you think that child is going into what kind of school situation? Is this a Muslim mother writing to her elementary school daughter? Is it a Christian father to his middle school son? Is it a black mother to her high school son? Or maybe it's the parent of a homosexual middle schooler, or the parent of a transgender child, or the parent of a heterosexual college freshman. I purposely selected those sentences because really that letter could, what I read, it could have been written to any of those situations. It's a parent concerned for their child going into a situation that seems not ideal, probably, possibly hostile. And the reason I bring that wide range of situations is because don't we all encounter that somewhere along the way? I mean, it could be any of these things. I mean, don't we feel like the minority sometimes, regardless of where we are? I mean, we're on the outside looking in, and everybody seems to have it easy and doing well, and we're the ones that are different. And they know it, and we feel it, and we don't like it. It's challenging. It's really challenging. We feel this way a lot when we go to school. Remember back to your school years. Even if you're in school, you can remember currently previous years where you're like, man, I am the only one. And that doesn't change when we get out of school. Sometimes we go into life and we still feel like I'm the only one. And we can feel that especially as Christians. Especially as Christians, because we have such different priorities and we can feel like we're entering into the world and entering into this hostile territory. But is it true? is the world really against Christians? Well, the simple answer is yes. At least, that's what Jesus said. If you have your outline, you can follow along. It's this yellow piece of paper. If you have a Bible, I encourage you to open it up. We're going to be looking at John 15. John 15, that's where we're going to start. We're going to hop all over the place as we consider what's going on here. Is the world really our enemy? As Christians, is the world against us? Well, Jesus said, yeah. He said it pretty plainly. Look at what he says here in John 15. He's just talking to his disciples, starting in verse 18. It says, if the world hates you, know that it has hated me before it hated you. If you were of the world would love you as its own. But because you are not of the world, but I chose you out of the world, therefore the world hates you. Remember the word that I said to you? A servant is not greater than his master. If they persecuted me, they will also persecute you. If they keep my word, they will also keep yours. But all these things they do to you on account of my name, because they do not know him who sent me. Verse 22. If I had not come and spoken to them, they would not have been guilty of sin. But now they have no excuse for their sin. Whoever hates me hates my Father also. If I had not done among them the works that no one else did, they would not be guilty of sin. But now they have seen and hated both me and my Father. But the word that is written in their law must be fulfilled. They hated me without a cause. Those opening verses make it pretty clear that Jesus says that the world is going to hate his followers. And why is the world going to hate his followers? Well, because they follow him. They're associated with him. And the world hates him. If the world hates you, know that it has hated me before it hated you. I mean, from the get-go, he's saying it very clearly, very plainly. Because what happens is when somebody starts trusting Jesus, puts their faith in Jesus, then they switch families. They leave behind the world that they were born into, and they enter into the family of God. And that association is so strong that it overrides all previous associations. That identity is so foundational that it transforms us to the core that we become recreated as a son or daughter of the living God when we put our faith in Christ. So it's a game changer. And it changes everything, and Jesus is saying that. You know, if you were of the world, then the world would know you as its own. But since you're from me, and you have faith in me, well, they're going to be hostile towards you because they're hostile towards me. We're going to be treated guilty by association because they did not like Jesus. And the question is why? How come the world didn't like Jesus? Why did it hate Jesus? Well, he mentions that in verse 22. I mean, look at what he says in verse 22. He says, if I had not come to spoken to them, they would not have been guilty of sin. But now they have no excuse for their sin. Jesus came, and when he came, he spoke with both of his actions and with his words to tell the truth about who God is and who we are. And part of that truth is that we sin. And people don't like hearing that. I mean, I don't like hearing that. But it's the truth. And what Jesus is saying here is that as he came and he taught, people were convicted of their sin. This is similar to what we looked at last week, part of it, where Paul says, if the law wouldn't have come and told me what covetousness is, I wouldn't have known that I coveted. There's lots of things that we don't know that we do wrong until we're called out on it. And that's what Jesus is doing. By his life, by his teachings, by examples, he's saying, look, here is the right holy way to live your life according to pleasing God in faith, in love, in submission. And there were lots of people that saw that and said, that's not how my life is, and I don't like what you're saying, Jesus, so I'm not going to like you. I mean, how do we receive bad news? Poorly. When somebody tells us the truth about something that we don't like about ourselves, what do? Do we say, yeah, you're right? In our humble moments, we do, but so often, how do we respond? We want to kill the messenger. We attack the person. Oh, yeah, well, you are... You don't know what's going on. And we get defensive, and sometimes the best defense is a good offense. So we turn it around on them. We kill the messenger. And while that's a figurative speech, this is literally what happened to Jesus. They did not like the message that he is, that he proclaimed, that he taught, that he told us to embrace. So they killed him. They killed the messenger. They crucified him. So yeah, the world is out to get Christians because the world was out to get Jesus. But what is this world? Okay, we need to define the terms here because sometimes we can have a word and it means lots of different things in different contexts. What's the idea here? When Jesus is talking here, when he says, the world hates you, it's hated me beforehand, what's he referring to? Well, the world, just like in our times, can mean a lot of different things. I mean, the world can refer to just the earth, what's been created. You know, we're living in this world. I stand in this world. We're not talking about Mars. We're talking about the world here. I mean, that could be part of it. It could be the created world. Another way of thinking about the world is that it's this time, this period, you know. It's not the age to come. It's the world we live in. Okay? It's not what's happening after this world. It's in this world now. Right? So that's another way. But most often in the Bible, especially in the book of John, when he mentions the world, he's talking about the people and the systems and the ideas and the things that are hostile with God. They're at enmity with God. They're opposing God. They're against him. And it's used in a sharp contrast with the things that are in line with God, the things that are from God, the things that are connected to God, the things that are following God and his people. So we have the things of this world that don't know and follow God, and then we have things of another world, the heavenly world, and that's what's connected to God. Let's look at 1 John. 1 John 2, a couple verses, three verses. It might be one of the clearest passages where we understand what the world is. 1 John 2, 15 through 17. Let me read these verses for you. It says, do not love the world or the things in the world. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. For all that is in the world, the desires of the flesh and the desires of the eyes and the pride in possessions, is not from the Father, but from the world. And the world is passing away along with its desires. But whoever does the will of God abides forever. Do you see the contrast there between the world and God, the things of the world and the things of God? I mean, do you see what it is? We have the world, the things of the world. Anyone who loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. Okay, if we're loving the world, then we don't have the love of the Father. And then he talks about what's in the world. We have the desires of the flesh as opposed to the desires of the Spirit. And we have the desires of the eyes as opposed to the desires of our faith. What our faith wants, right? We live by faith, not by sight. We have the pride of possessions in the world, as opposed to what? Just like an open-handedness trust that God will give us what we need. And the most important things aren't the things that we grab onto and that we've earned and we've accumulated for ourselves, but the things that have been given in grace, the things that we never could have gotten ourselves, but the gifts that God has given to us. So it's not the pride of possessions. Look at what I have done and accumulated. No, no, that's compared to the humility of look what God has given me, even though I don't deserve it. And it's the intangibles, the spiritual. And what does he say? This is not from the Father, but from the world. And the world is passing away. The world is temporary. It's fading. We recognize that. Look at how many things we have to replace on a regular basis. Even things in our body we have to replace. I am not going to ask you how many of you have had a knee replacement. Okay? I mean, we have things that we constantly are trying to upgrade and keep going because the things of this world don't last. But whoever does the will of God abides forever. The things of the Father last forever. They're eternal because God himself is eternal. So do you see how there's those contrasts, things that are going here and there, things that are temporary and eternal, things of the world, things of God. But let's look again at this, okay? Because as we're talking about the world, look again at verse 16 and notice what it says and what it doesn't say. Okay, let's read verse 16. It says, for all that is in the world, the desires of the flesh and the desires of the eyes and the pride in possessions is not from the Father, but from the world. What's in the world? What's in the world? We have the desires of the flesh, the desires of the eyes, and the pride in possessions. These are the things that are in the world. Notice what it doesn't say is in the world. It doesn't mention people. It doesn't mention people in that verse, as in the world, or things of the world. But where do these desires reside? Where are the desires of flesh and our desires of our eyes and the pride? They're not just out there. They're not living in trees. It's not in your TV screen. No, they're in people. So this is a very interesting thing. This is kind of hard to understand, but I think I got an illustration that'll help us. Where the things of the world are not people, but the things of the world are in people. And that's very helpful because sometimes too often Christians will think that the world is made up of bad people. Like that's what we think about, bad people when we think about the world. But that's not what this verse is talking about. This verse is talking about something else. It's talking about the desires within people are things of the world. Let me see if I can use an illustration that can help clear this up. Hopefully it does. And if it doesn't, then come up and talk with me afterwards. I'd be happy to try to sort this out. Let's think about Disney. Okay? Disney. What is Disney? I mean, Disney's a huge company. It's huge. I didn't realize how big it was until I started thinking about this analogy. I mean, obviously, Disney is a company, so it's made up of people. But listen to all the other companies that it owns, things that it has, like, sway in, okay, influence. I mean, it's huge. I mean, Disney owns ABC, ESPN, Touchstone Pictures, Marvel, Lucasfilms, half of A&E, half of the History Channel, half of Lifetime, Pixar, Hollywood Records, Core Publishing, and it owns the franchise rights to Star Wars, The Muppets, The Marvel Cinematic Universe, Disney Princes and Princes, The Chronicles of Narnia, The Pirates of the Caribbean, Winnie the Pooh, Indiana Jones, Grey's Anatomy. No millennials there. There should have been a shout out, not that one. All right. And what else does Disney own? It has parks in California, Florida, Paris, Tokyo, Shanghai, and Hong Kong. Now, there's more to Disney than that. I mean, I didn't even mention all the TV shows, the TV stations, the streaming, the merchandisings, all the things go along with it. Not to mention the people that are involved with it. I mean, we have employees, stockholders, and customers. Right? So Disney is huge. It's massive. And if we were to get all the people together in one spot, we couldn't just stay there and be like, what's Disney? There's Disney. Disney is just all these people. No, there's more to Disney than just the people. I mean, there's all these intangible things that have to do with Disney. I mean, think about like the Disney magic and the spirit of Disney and the values of Disney and the soul of Disney and the heart. Like there's all these intangible things that you can't say, here, let's just get a bunch of people together and that's Disney. Now, Disney's huge. It's massive and it's bigger than just the people that are involved with it. And hopefully you see the parallel that I'm trying to illustrate here, where the world is bigger than just the people that are part of it. There's systems and structures and values and principles and teachings and actions. All these things contribute to the world. And if you think about how big Disney is, I mean, they got Disney in Tokyo? They got a park over there in Tokyo? You think about how big it is, how worldwide it is, how complex it is to have all those structures, to make all these things happen, to keep the spirit alive. I mean, it's complicated. But that is a very small thing when you compare it to the world as everything in creation that is opposed to God. Everything that is in creation that does not submit and follow to God's ways. That does not line up with who he is. So Disney's very big. But if you compare it to everything that's going against God, that's rebelling against him or ignoring him or dismissing him and his ways, the world is massive. The world, the way that John talks about the world, do not love the things of the world. It's huge and it's complicated and it's more than just people. Now I want to make another comparison, okay? If we got all those people together in Disney, wherever they were. Like, I'm not so foolish to think that everybody that's engaged with Disney is like a Disney hardcore person. I mean, there's some temp person there, high school students that got a part-time job, and she's like, yeah, I'm just doing this because they give me a paycheck. Like, there's somebody at some park that's pretending to be Belle that's like, I hate this job, but I think I can stick it out because it's going to be my big break, and I'm going to get into showbiz this way. I know that there's somebody somewhere in the planet that's connected with Disney that's like, I got 3 more years. I don't really care how your day went at Epcot. yeah, I think that the food is overpriced as well, but I'm just doing this because I need this retirement and it's too late for me to switch jobs. I actually hate Disney, but it's my job, so I'm connected with it. Like, yeah, there's people that exist that way. And that's the same way that it is with the world. Not everybody that's connected to the world has like these sinister ideas, you know? It's not everybody that's like, oh man, let me just see how I can screw up Christians. I mean, we talked about schools earlier, and the schools is a massive place. It's a complex system. And increasingly, it's going away from God instead of towards him. And it's teaching things that are contrary to God instead of things that are in line with him. But I don't think that the superintendent of the school district that you're in is just like looking and saying like, man, you know, Rome got it right. Like they were onto something when they were throwing Christians to the lions. How can I work lions into the gym curriculum so we can throw Christian kids to the lions? We need to get that back in the public school system. Like, he's probably not thinking that. Right? He's just trying to do his job. She's trying to figure out, how can I prepare these kids for the world? And I think that's where the difference is. Where Christians, we're trying to say, how do we prepare these kids for eternity? Not just this world. So let's just keep this in mind, because sometimes it's very easy when we think about who our enemies are is just to start mislabeling, get distracted, and actually get confused on who the real enemies are. I mean, your enemy is not the person in your family who has super ultra conservative or liberal or libertarian or apathetic views of what it is. That is not your enemy. Your enemy is not your neighbor or your coworker who thinks that love should be love and whoever loves whoever wants to is going to be okay, and that if you think and act differently, then you're a bigot. That's not your enemy. Your enemy is not the friend of your son or your daughter who feels like they're gender fluid or non-binary or other terms that we don't understand. That person is not your enemy. These are people that are made in the image of God, but they have ideas and beliefs and values that are contrary to God. And those beliefs and ideas and those values that oppose God, those are our enemies. And they are within people. All people are made in the image of God, so they should be loved and valued. But all people are sinful, and we're all deceived, and we're all wrong and selfish. And the things that we do and the desires that we have and the beliefs that we hold that are against God, we need to be aware of that. And we need to be ready to oppose those ideas. So let's keep these big enemies, the biggest enemy in mind from all this. Remember, for we do not wrestle against flesh and blood, but against the rulers, against the authorities, against the cosmic powers over this spiritual dark, this present darkness, against the spiritual forces of evil in the heavenly places. Our big enemy is not flesh and blood. It's not people. Our biggest enemy is sin. Our biggest enemy is sin. Why? Sin is what separates us from God. Sin is what damns us. Sin is what brings death. And what the world is trying to do is influence us towards sin. And that's the danger of the world. That's why the world is our enemy, is because it's trying to keep us from God and influencing us more and more so that we sin. We sin. Nobody makes us sin. We sin. But the world is influencing us from sin, this great enemy. And that's why Jesus is the great defeater of sin, because Jesus came to save us from our sins so that we can be reconciled to God. We can be declared righteous so that we don't have death, but we have eternal life. Now, this idea of world versus God could be very confusing, and it's unlikely that people think about this on a regular basis. But let me give a couple of examples of how we can see how the world is so contrary to God. And there's a couple of questions. There's lots of questions that people are asking. I'm just pointing out two questions. Look at these two important questions and see how they're answered differently from the world and from Jesus. Let's look at this first question. This first question is, what is freedom? What is freedom? How is this question answered in our culture today? Okay, what is freedom? I mean, isn't freedom the ability to do whatever you want without anybody stopping you? You want to be able to live with no restraints, no interference. You can go where you want to go, do what you want to do. You can be who you want to be. Like, isn't that the ultimate freedom? Nothing's stopping me. I just get to go. Does that kind of summarize it? I mean, that seems like to me what freedom is. But what does Jesus say freedom is? Because it's a very different picture than what the world says. Let's read John 8. John 8, he's having this conversation, and he's talking with some of the Pharisees, some Jews. And listen to what he says here, okay? John 8, let me start in verse 31. So Jesus said to the Jews who had believed in him, "If you abide in my word, you are truly my disciples, and you will know the truth, and the truth will set you free." And they answered, "We are offspring of Abraham and have never been enslaved to anyone. How is it that you say you will become free?" Verse 34, Jesus answered them, "Truly, truly, I say to you, everyone who commits sin is a slave to sin. The slave does not remain in the house forever. The son remains forever. So if the son sets you free, you will be free indeed. I know that you are offsprings of Abraham, yet you seek to kill me because my words find no place in you. I speak of what I have seen with my father, and you speak of what you have heard from your father." Who's their father? Well, we'll talk about that next week. You got to come back. Or you can just read ahead. You know, you got a Bible. You can read ahead there. But do you see how Jesus is talking about what true freedom is? What does he say here in verse 32? "And you'll know the truth, and the truth will set you free." And after that, they're like, "Wait, what are you talking about? We've never been enslaved," which is kind of a crazy thing because they're under the oppression of Rome at that time. But, you know, let's set that aside. And he says, "Look, everyone who commits a sin is a slave to sin. What's sin? It's disregarding God's ways. It's lawlessness. It's anything that's not done in faith to God." Man, remember what we talked about what the world's idea of freedom is? Just going, not having any restraints, being who you want to be, not having to listen to anybody else. Nothing stopping you, nothing preventing you, nothing interrupting you. That's what they said freedom is. And in doing that, they're saying, well, you can even disregard God. And God calls that sin. And here Jesus says that sin that the world says is freedom actually binds you. You actually become a slave to sin. Which is why Paul said, the things that you don't want to do, you still do. Because you're a slave to sin. So how do we get this freedom? What's this ultimate freedom that Jesus says? He says, well, if you have the truth will set you free. And later on, Jesus will say, "I am the way and the truth." Which is why he says, if the Son sets you free, if Jesus says the truth sets you free, if you trust in Jesus as the Son of God, as truth, as the substitute, so where you should have been punished, he took your punishment on the cross. Where you should have been condemned, he died for you. And he raised to life so that you could be free. If the Son sets you free, you are free indeed. True freedom is knowing Jesus. It's having a relationship, being connected to him through faith. This is what real freedom is. You see how that's a very different answer than what the world says freedom is, than what we hear, than what we're encouraged to pursue so often? Let's look at this next question, and it's going to connect a lot with what we just talked about. What is life? What is life? Well, isn't life about getting the most, the fastest way you can? Being the biggest and the best at whatever you do? Being both safe and healthy while living on the edge and seeking adventure? Isn't that what life's about? Being known and liked while not caring what other people think, but embracing and being who you are, who you truly are, being a priest yourself, regardless of whatever other people think, but you still got to be known and liked. Isn't life about making a difference, making an impact, having the most influence? It's about having a lot of options, a lot of opportunities, having a lot of experiences, finding love and being close with friends and family while being completely independent so that you don't need anyone. I mean, isn't that what we hear all the time from movies and shows and songs and videos and articles and friends and family and conversation? Isn't that what we're hearing all the time, what life is about? I mean, it sounds like life is connected closely with this idea of freedom, that we can do whatever we want, whenever we want. And this is the fullest life. I mean, just think about the commercials that you see. Think about the advertisements. Think about the conversations. Think about what people are trying to do, what they're trying to achieve, what they're living for. I mean, doesn't this seem like this is what life is all about? The here and now, and getting the most out of it. You know, there's a guy in the Bible who tried to do this. He tried to live a lot like this too. I'm going to read a portion of his journal, if you will. It's in Ecclesiastes 2. He calls himself the preacher. All right. Do you ever wish you could give yourself a nickname like that? Just call me the preacher. You know, don't really call me the preacher because I am a preacher, but you know, I mean, it'd just be cool. It'd be like, I'm Batman. No, you're not. Well, just call me Batman anyway. You know, that's how I address myself that in the journal, Batman. You know, it's like, we get that. That'd be fun. Listen to what the preacher has to say on his reflections about his life. All right, let me look here. Ecclesiastes 2, let me start in verse 1. I said in my heart, come now, I will test you with pleasure. Enjoy yourself. See, everybody talks to themselves, okay? But behold, this also was vanity. I said of laughter, it is mad, and of pleasure, what use is it? I searched with my heart how to cheer my body with wine, my heart still guiding me with wisdom, and how to lay hold of folly, till I might see what was good for the children of man to do under heaven during the few days of their life. I made great works. I built houses and planted vineyards for myself. I made myself gardens and parks and planted them in all kinds of fruit trees. I made myself pools from which water to the forest of growing trees. I brought male and female slaves and had slaves who were born in my house. I also had possessions of herds and flocks, more than any who had been before me in Jerusalem. I also gathered for myself silver and gold and the treasures of the kings and the provinces. I got singers, both men and women, and many concubines, the delight of the children of man. I mean, he had it all. He had it all. Verse 9, so I became great and surpassed all who were before me in Jerusalem. Also, my wisdom remained with me. And whatever my eyes desired, remember the desires of the eyes? Remember that phrase? Whatever my eyes desired, I did not keep from them. I kept my heart from no pleasure, for my heart found pleasure in all of my toil, all of my work. And this was my reward for all of my toil. Then I considered all that my hands had done and the toil that I had expended in doing it, and behold, it was all vanity and striving after the wind, and there was nothing to be gained under the sun. The preacher, the dude, he had it all. He didn't deny himself anything, and he had the resources to make it happen. Whatever he wanted, he got. And what was his conclusion? It was all vanity. It was empty. It was meaningless. Like chasing after the wind. What does the world say is life? Well, the preacher lived it. And what's his experience? Read through and you kind of get the idea that he's on the brink of insanity because it's so empty and hollow and meaningless. Well, let's contrast this to what Jesus has to say about life. And he says it a little bit shorter there than the way Jesus does. Look in here. Look at Mark 8. I'm going to start in verse 34, and I'm just going to read four verses. Jesus is having this conversation with his disciples, and there's a crowd around him, and look what happens in verse 34. It says, and calling in the crowd to him with his disciples, he said to them, if anyone would come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. For whoever would save his life will lose it. But whoever loses his life for my sake and the gospel's will save it. For what does it profit a man to gain the whole world and forfeit his soul? For whoever is ashamed of me and my words in this adulterous and sinful generation, you could say this age, you could say this world, right? This time period. Of him will the Son of Man be ashamed when it comes in the glory of the Father with his holy angels. You could say, in the next world. What does Jesus say life is? He says it's not the accumulation of lots of things. Because what does it profit a man to gain the whole world and yet lose his soul? to lose the emptiness, the essence of who he is, to be empty there. That was the experience of the preacher in chapter 2. So what does Jesus say that life is? But whoever loses his life for my sake and the gospel's will save it. If you use this time period, this life that you have now, if you give it away in faith to God, for his ways, then you will gain life. And it won't be your life, and it won't be the life in this world. It'll be Jesus' life. You give your life away to receive his life, his eternal life, his joyful life, his perfect life that is connected with the Father. As you put your faith in him, you're united with him, and that means you get what he has. He has life. He is life. And you get that. And you give away your life here. This life that's passing, that's fading, that's in some ways kind of meaningless apart from God, in order to grab onto his life. I mean, this is why Jesus says, seek first his kingdom, and all these things that you're seeking, all these things that you desire, all of them will be added to you. But seek first the kingdom. Seek first the king. Seek first to be in a connection relationship with God, which only comes about with faith in Jesus. You see how they're like very different? I mean, the world is asking lots of questions. People are asking lots and lots of questions like these. Sometimes consciously, sometimes subconsciously. Sometimes openly, sometimes after a tragedy, or maybe even after hollowness. I mean, so you hear about these stories, these Olympic people that they're there, they did it. I trained my whole life, I've got a gold. Now what? I go back and my body doesn't work the way it does anymore. The sponsors have run out and I'm 30. I got a whole rest of my life for me, and all I've known is pursuing this gold, and I got it. And I feel empty. The world is asking these questions. People are asking these questions, and the world is giving them answers. But are they good answers? Are they lasting answers? No. We have to look to God for the eternal. We cannot look to the temporary. We cannot look to the world. So what do we do? How do we wrap this up? Okay, Jim, you've convinced me, or maybe I haven't, that the world is my enemy. It doesn't want what's best for me. God does. So now what? Well, there's a couple things. I just got two action points, two steps. One is get discernment. Get discernment. Learn to distinguish between truth and lie, from reality, falsehood, from eternal to temporary, right from wrong, good from bad. Learn to discern these things, because we have an enemy, sin, that's using another enemy, the world, to try to trick us and keep us separated from God. And I mean, it doesn't take, I mean, just look around. Discernment is in short order. It's not there. And you don't have to look far. I know for me, I can look in the mirror and I'll see somebody that needs discernment. So get discernment. Well, how can you do it? Well, you're probably not going to find it on TV. If you find a pill for it, taking that pill is the opposite of discernment, okay? So you haven't gotten it there. And discernment comes from knowing the truth. And what is the truth? Jesus is the truth. His word is the truth. Read the Bible regularly, again and again and again and again, so that it will soak into who you are and shape you, so that you will know the truth, not just in your head, but within your heart, not just the concept, but the person. Jesus says that he is the truth. Know the truth. Read your word again and again, because it will tell us what is reality and what's fading, what's an image, where we've been duped. And the second thing to do is to speak up. When you know the truth, speak up. Now, I'm not saying that you got to go get the sandwich board out and, you know, go out to the 70 and be like, okay, here, everybody, let's go. Hell's coming. I mean, you don't got to do that. Now, if the Lord tells you to do that, then I think that you should do that. But I'm just saying, when you have opportunities, speak up. When you see that there are some people that are erring in their ways, they're not thinking correctly, they don't know the truth, they've been deceived, they've never been exposed to the truth, speak up. Share the truth. Share the truth of God. Share who he is. I mean, how do we love? How do we love? I skipped this verse. I'm going to go back to it here. Look at Galatians. Galatians 5, 13 and 14. Oops, I missed it. There we go. How do we speak up? This is the attitude that we use when we speak up. For you were called to freedom, brothers. Only do not use your freedom as an opportunity for the flesh, but through love serve one another. For the whole law is fulfilled in one word. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. Do you want to know the truth? When you're headed in the wrong direction that's leading to pain and suffering and death and evil, do you want somebody to just stand by and say, have a good trip? You're good enough. Or do you want somebody to tell you the truth? Do you want somebody to speak up? Because here, what are we supposed to use our freedom for? Not for our own selves, but to love and serve one another. Love your neighbor as yourself. Get discernment. Speak up. Now, this is hard. This is challenging. But it's not impossible. We have the Spirit of God in us when we trust Christ. And he will give us courage and boldness. And I encourage you to start speaking up first in your home with the people that you live with. Talk with them. Encourage each other. And maybe you have some people in your home that aren't believers. Be kind, be gentle, be wise, be sensitive, be bold. Speak up. Practice with them. And parents that have kids in their home, speak up with your kids. Train them. Talk with them. Lead them. They may not be asking these questions yet, but that doesn't stop the world from giving the answers first. We've got to give the answers before they start asking the questions. Because if we wait until they ask the questions, it'll be too late. Because the world has already been giving them answers. Do your kids have access to screens? Do they have friends who don't know Jesus? Do they go to the public school system? Let's just do this. Do they go outside and interact with people? If your kids go outside and they interact with people, then they're hearing the message of the world. So make your home a place where you're giving the message of the gospel, of the truth, of the good news of who Jesus is, what he has done, and how sin is our real enemy, but we have victory over it, not because of ourselves, but because of Jesus. We want to help you, parents with kids at home, we want to help you with this. That's why we're having that middle school orientation coming up. That's why we're doing something special today for Promotion Sunday with the kids. That's why in September, we're going to have another parents meeting to talk about this. Still working on the dates. Keep it open. We'll let you know soon. But we want to help you with this. And as a church, we want to help each other with this. So what do? We get discernment, read the Bible, and then as we have opportunities, and as we look for opportunities, and as we create opportunities, let us speak up. You know what's an easy way to create an opportunity? Somebody says something that you don't agree with, just say, you know, I disagree. Or you could say, I think a little differently. That's one way of looking at it. You don't got to be a jerk. Somebody says something, be like, well, that's the way the person going to hell thinks. You don't have to say that. You know, you can think that if you want to be an idiot. You don't have to be that guy. In fact, don't be that guy. It's like, I disagree. I think there's other ways to think about it. Have you ever thought about it from this way? Let's look at it from this angle. That invites conversation. And those are opportunities to speak up. Not yell, but to talk. But to talk boldly. And to talk truth. And to talk in love so that we would serve one another as we love one another. The way that God loved us. That he told us the truth in our time of need. That while we were still sinners, Christ died for us. Let's share this good news. Let me pray. God, we thank you for the gospel. We thank you for Jesus. We thank you for your Spirit that gives wisdom and discernment. And oh, God, we need it. We need it so badly. Thank you that you're generous to all who ask. Let us ask again and again. Let us not get tired of asking. Give us perseverance. Encourage us again and again to ask again and again for the good gifts that you give, which is of yourself. Thank you for Christ. And God, I pray for discernment, that we would have wisdom, that we would see clearly truth from lies. righteousness and holiness from wickedness and evil, that we would see what love is and we would pursue you, Jesus. And we would encourage others to do the same. Give us courage. Help us to speak up. Thank you for forgiving us when we don't. And thank you for giving us opportunities again and again and again. Let us be bold and encourage each other to take it, to speak the truth. Because when we know the truth, then we're truly set free. So we praise you, Jesus, for being the truth. We ask it in your name. Amen.